Hi, welcome to the Freedom from Fibromyalgia Summit. I'm Dr. Roger Murphy, and I'm delighted to be your host. I've got my friend and colleague, Dr. Peter Kahn. Peter is a board-certified chiropractic neurologist and a board-certified functional medicine practitioner. He practices in Arizona, but he has a telemedicine practice like I do. He works with patients all over the world. We've been on numerous podcasts and summits together. And so today, I really look forward to our conversation because it can go some different directions that we sometimes get off on a tangent. But there's always a lot of material that comes from our conversations that people can use right away to help them in their quest to feel good again. So Peter, wow, here we are. We're back at it again. Thanks for joining me on the summit.
Thank you so much for having me, Roger. I think, it can be a big, you know, multiple rabbit holes, you know, feel like it's off tangent, but in fact, they're all kind of connected. So let's see if we can help these people connect the dots.
You know, that's what I love about you is when we have these conversations, we kind of wrap it all up to where it all comes together. Hopefully we'll do that today. Hey, but let's talk about nerve pain and what we see with fibromyalgia, this whole central sensitization pain syndrome. Let's talk a little bit about that. Can you explain, you know, some of your work with neurology and what you see in fibromyalgia patients?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in the nervous system, we have the central nervous system, which is your brains, brainstem, and spinal cord, everything midline. And then we have the peripheral nervous system, which is from the spinal nerve root and out all the way to your fingertips, that controls, you know, sensory information as well as motor information. So when we say central sensitization, we're referring to sensitization of, you know, your body to pain from a central perspective, meaning brain, spinal cord. Yeah. So you can have central sensitization because those area have ways to naturally dampen pain. For example, in the spinal cord, you have within the spinal cord regions that can actually produce serotonin within the spinal cord that locally mediates pain. That's your body's naturally pain blocking mechanism. In fact, you know, a nociception, which is a sensory sensation or a type of input that generates pain, nociception is actually the norm. Like we're constantly generating nociceptive inputs. Yeah. And so as long as that nociception, that pain input, it's not greater than the threshold, then you don't really feel it. It's almost like this noise, right? You have this background noise, you can tune it out, but the noise gets too high, then it's like you start to hear it and you start to notice it. So we have a certain amount of threshold for kind of blocking out this background nociception. But when it pokes above that threshold, that's when you experience it as pain. So pain is actually an emotional phenomena, a limbic phenomena. It's a central nervous system perception, but really nociception is the raw data that comes in. But you don't notice the raw data until it pokes through a certain threshold. Now you experience as a pain, and there's an emotional component to that pain as well. So central sensitization means that threshold has been lowered, so it's easier for you to feel pain. As Roger has talked about many times in fibromyalgia, there's this condition of hyperalgia, right? So then even normal pressures will make this person hurt with fibromyalgia where other people wouldn't. It's the same concept where you just become sensitized. Now, why would you become sensitized to it? Well, it turns out that your cortex, your brain, is constantly firing, right? Well, it's constantly receiving information as well from the environment. That's what the brain does. It's a big old antenna to pick up sensory cues from the environment through sight, taste, smell, touch. And then so these sensory input tells the brain that, okay, we need to do something to avoid danger or go find food. So the brain from that sensory input is creating output, right? Stuff comes in and your brain say, okay, we interpret this, we generate output. That output's going to be motoric, like meaning movement to get you to move away from danger or move toward food. Right. It can be autonomic function to get you to shiver or to get you to, you know, digest food and whatnot. But the output of the brain is really important because that cortical output ultimately is what actually controls your brainstem parasympathetic and sympathetic function. In fact, 90% of your cortical output of what your brain generate as far as signal going back out to the body, 90% of it goes to your brainstem to control autonomic function. In fact, actually 90% of it is really to help support that parasympathetic function. Okay. And by virtue of firing into the parasympathetic, you're inhibiting the sympathetics because it's a teeter-totter. So 90% of what your brain does is to fire to parasympathetics to generate that rest and digest function so that you feel relaxed and calm. And by virtue of having that function really good, you're inhibiting the sympathetics. So when you start to lose cortical output, you lose the inhibition or the brake on that sympathetic system. So the sympathetics start to creep up. Now you're in more of a fight or flight response, even though when there's no reason to, at baseline. Yeah. And we're constantly firing off that fight or flight response. A lot of things happen. Your type C fibers, these are little tiny pain fibers, can become sensitized. Yeah. And you may lose integration and modulation of the spinal cord serotonin production, so that you can't modulate pain as well. So these are just some of the reasons why that will happen. Now, so then people may ask, what's the reason why your cortex don't fire? Mm-hmm. Well, that's because there could be inflammation in the brain or lack of fuel or activation to the brain. So to kind of put neurology in a very simple way, brain cells, really any type of neurons, not just in the brain, but even in the peripheral nervous system, neurons survive when they have fuel, and fuel comes in the form of glucose and oxygen. Of course, you can burn ketone as an alternative fuel, but glucose is the preferred source of fuel. Yeah. And then you need fuel, you need activation. That means your body has to move. In fact, movement is one of the things that kind of inhibit and block nociception, right? Yeah. We talk about this nociceptive input. It has to get above certain threshold before you experience it as pain. Movement actually can dampen that. So we need to, but on a neurological level, your brain cells needs to have movement, because that activates brain cells and that keeps the brain cells healthier. So we need fuel, activation. We have to have absence of inflammation, because inflammation damages brain cells, which all of those things, if you don't have enough fuel or activation or inflammation, you're going to decrease the frequency of firing of the cortex, which means the brain cells can't fire at the normal pace. It's slower, then that's kind of slowed down the overall firing of the vagus nerve, the parasympathetics, which will cause the sympathetic overdrive. Now you get this whole situation that can kind of look like someone with fibromyalgia, right? People with fibromyalgia have pain sensitivity. They can't sleep, perhaps partly due to the fight or flight response. They may have light and sound sensitivity. Now, light and sound information goes into the midbrain, mesencephalic area. That is an area in the brainstem, and light and sound fires into the area in the superior colliculus and the inferior colliculus. And so that's all in the brainstem fight or flight center. It's called the midbrain, mesencephalon. Yeah. So in people who are already very fight or flight dominant, then that area is already overfiring, because you have lost cortical function and lost parasympathetic. So your fight or flight is overfiring. Then the excess light and sound come in will be too much for them, because that area is already being charged up. So then that's why a lot of people with fibro will have light and sound sensitivity. Yeah. And then they may have digestion issues because the vagus nerve is not being controlled properly. Yeah. And then they may have gas and bloating, they may have leaky gut, lack of blood flow to the gut. And then they may have constipation, they may have bowel troubles, and finally may even have urinary issues, because remember, the parasympathetic extends all the way down into, you know, urination, defecation, and sexual function. And that's controlled by the sacral plexus, sacral parasympathetic. So if you don't have good parasympathetic function, that extends all the way down into the sacral area that innervate the bladder and the rectum. So then you may have like frequent urination, or you may have UTIs because things are, urine just sitting in there too long. So fluid sits there, you get bacterial infections. You may have, constipation issues, or you may have sexual dysfunction. So I think, so fibromyalgia, right? Yeah. So people are treating it, a lot of the Western allopathic doctor are treating fibromyalgia like it's its own entity. But fibromyalgia really just the end result of all these things going wrong.
Yeah. So great explanation. You went into a lot of detail. And I want to piggyback on some of that. But I had Dr. Rob Downey on here last week or 2 weeks ago. I did an interview with him, and he gave this analogy about central sensitization pain syndrome, where you go to this crowded ballroom and there's hundreds of people in there, and they're all bunched up in little bitty bands of conversation, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 people there. You walk into that room and you're overwhelmed with all this noise, all these different conversations coming at you at once. It just, you know, it's all this noise and, you know, can be kind of stressful. But then you get into your own little group there and you start carrying on a conversation, 5, 6 people, and eventually you tone everything out. And all you're hearing is the person right here in your little circle. And that's kind of what our nervous system is doing, right? But with fibro, you can't tune it out. So you go to get in this little little group of people here to have this conversation, and you can't tune all these other conversations out. It's overwhelming. And then from that, your nervous system becomes, as you said, becomes complacent. It can't balance itself. So you've got, we know with fibromyalgia, the sympathetic nervous system is overly hyper, aggressive. And the parasympathetic nervous calms everything down is being kind of turned off. And so these people walk around wired and tired all day. They have all this nervous energy that's going on. They can't handle stimulation, bright lights, loud noises, things that, you know, you and I would take for granted. To them, it's just overwhelming. And it all comes down to the fact that they just don't have this balanced nervous system, right?
Many times it is, if not the root cause, it is a part of the picture, right? There's other ways that you could create that situation as a byproduct of other things. Yes.
Right. And so with fibromyalgia, which is just a name given to describe a group of common symptoms, you know, and then we're really, as a functional medicine practitioner, we're trying to look at, okay, what are the underlying causes of these symptoms? And you mentioned numerous ones. So let's talk a little bit about the gut-brain connection, a little bit about that and the role that that plays in our health. Because with fibromyalgia, we know that 70% of those with fibromyalgia have some type of irritable bowel syndrome diagnosis, you know, bloating, gas, indigestion, loose bowel movements, constipation. There's a common denominator with central sensitization pain syndrome. That's a mouthful this morning. Both with fibro and with irritable bowel syndrome, we see the connection there, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And remember, from the perspective of central sensitization, as I explained earlier, central means the central nervous system, brain stem, spinal cord. And the brain and the brain stem is going to be responsible for a lot of that parasympathetic, because 90% of the output of the cortex is going to fire into the pontomedullary formation, which is in your brain stem that controls parasympathetic function. So if you don't have good function there, then you are going to have decreased parasympathetic because of the decreased vagus nerve output. The vagus nerve is one of the predominant nerves that come out of the cranium, one of the cranial nerves that fires into parasympathetic. Now you have other parasympathetic nerves. You know, you have facial nerve that controls lacrimation and salivation. You have, you know, the oculomotor nerve that control pupil constriction. So you have other cranial nerves that control parasympathetic function, but the vagus nerve is the most predominant and the most important one. Okay. It innervates the gut, but also innervates the heart, innervates the lung. So I have roles in respiration and breathing, as well as digestion. In fact, this vagus nerve innervation goes all the way down to 2/3 of the way through the transverse colon, kind of at the splenic flexure, which is like where the spleen is on the left side. So it goes pretty far down. Okay. It doesn't go all the way down to the rectum. That's again, the sacral plexus. So if you lose parasympathetic or lose vagus nerve output, then secretion of all digestive, you know, secretions are going to decrease. That's stomach acid. That's going to be your pancreatic enzyme. That's going to be your bile from the gallbladder. And then when you don't make enough enzyme, then you can't digest food. So you don't digest food well, food kind of sits there and they rot. And as they rot, they can create acid reflux symptoms. So you're mistaken that for too much acid when you don't have enough because the food is rotting and turning acidic on you. And moreover, the food that's not digested well has a chance to become fermented by bacteria and fungus. And then that's your SIBO and candida overgrowth. So some of these SIBO issue is really an outgrowth of just poor vagal outflow so that you're not digesting. And on top of that, vagus nerve also controls intestinal motility, which is a downward beating movement of the intestinal tract to push food down, right? Digestion goes from north to south. So then if you can't continuously have this wave-like action to push food down, then the food kind of can sit there or even regurgitate up, maybe, you know, going from the large intestine back up through the ileocecal valve or whatnot. Then you're going to get, again, SIBO and these bacterial fermentation. So you get gut dysbiosis and gut infections that you normally wouldn't get simply because you have poor central control of these digestive function. And just remember, good parasympathetic, right, diverts blood to the core in a digestive tract, right? When you're in fight or flight, blood is diverted to the skeletal muscle so you can fight or flight. In parasympathetic, then the blood is diverted toward the gut to help you to digest food. So if you don't have good blood flow to the gut due to a lack of parasympathetics, you can't heal your gut lining. Your gut lining is one cell layer thick, right? It turns over every 3 days, one of the fastest turnover rates in the body as far as cell turnover. So your intestinal lining needs a lot of nutrients, which means it's going to come from your blood supply. So if you don't have good blood supply to the gut, you're going to get leaky gut more likely, and you can't transport nutrient as well. So then this is where a lot of these digestive issue could be coming from a central perspective. Now, certainly you can have low stomach acid because of some other reason, like H. pylori. You can have, like, you know, low, poor bile issues because you have gallbladder sludge, because you have toxicity or hormone issues. You can have issues in all those areas that I talked about separately, but we have to keep in mind that the central mechanism is very important. It could be a backdrop for why those things are not happening. So people started to develop leaky gut. And so the people are taking supplements for leaky gut. And if you're not getting anywhere with that, then maybe you want to consider that there may be a neurological component.
Yeah. So how do we balance these systems? Because with fibromyalgia, as I mentioned, the sympathetic nervous system is hyper alert. It's over aggressive. The calming part of the nervous system, the parasympathetic, is largely dormant. And, you know, these folks get in this state where they just can't get out of it. Stress becomes so magnified that little things that again, you and I wouldn't even think anything about, even the thought of, you know, going out with friends or going to the grocery store or, you know, just little things that we would just be nothing to us. Just the thought, a stressful thought, can send them over the edge and put them into a flare. How do you start to balance that nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic? For me, you know, I always want to calm everything down first. So it's a combination of nutraceuticals, over-the-counter supplements, the right ones for them, and then also really trying to get them to do more stress coping things like meditation and prayer and journaling and stretching, just light exercise, things that are really start to bring that overreactive sympathetic nervous system down a little bit, calm it down, so we can start to see the parasympathetic rise back up and give them some relief.
Those are all great suggestions and great tools. Yes, absolutely. Calming down the system oftentimes is one of the better first step, because they can get immediate relief from having that first move of just calming the fire down. So they're not dealing with so much anymore.
Right.
I see in some people that is not enough. Most of the time, though, people can make progress by focusing on the important thing, like, as you say, meditation, you know, healing leaky gut, stabilize your blood sugar, right? These things are very, and cutting out reactive foods. These are things that we do as a functional medicine practitioner on a day-to-day basis, and we kind of take it for granted. But to a lot of other people, this may be, wow, you know, like, how do I go about doing that? So this is where talking to Roger and talking to other functional medicine practitioners can be helpful to help you create a program. But sometimes it's not enough, because I think people need to realize that the body is complex and it's all connected. We can simplify it, but know that the body is infinitely, our creator done a pretty darn good job creating us. Okay. So we have multiple redundant backup mechanisms to compensate, to keep us alive, to keep us going despite dysfunction. But what happens is, in that compensation, we create multiple vicious cycles. So I think first step, what I would do, if someone is not doing very well or not making progress as much, we may have to look at some of these other factors. So for example, you say some of these people, they're just constantly just not doing well. The brain function is not good. They're tired, they're fatigued. So that brain symptom that people get, you know, the fibro fog, the fatigue, the depression, even the anxiety, those are really a sign of brain inflammation. You know, so when your brain gets inflamed, you get those type of brain symptom. Right. So then the question is, why does the brain becomes inflamed? Well, the brain can become inflamed because your body is inflamed. Okay, so when your body's inflamed, your brain's inflamed. So then, okay, why would the body become inflamed? Well, your body can become inflamed because you have metabolic problems, like, you know, your blood sugar is not good, you have insulin resistance. Your body can become inflamed because you have leaky gut. So then here we go. Gut inflammation leads to body, when I say body, meaning systemic, right? People think gut inflammation, oh, it's just the inflammation in my gut. Like you have a rash on your skin, it's just right there. That's not how it works. When you have gut inflammation, you get systemic inflammation. And when you get systemic inflammation, that all spills into the brain, you get brain inflammation. So that's why when we say gut on fire, brain on fire, really it kind of goes through the body, right? So what happens is when people have leaky gut or gut inflammation, that drives systemic inflammation, that drives brain inflammation. So now we have kind of this cycle here. And then because they're inflamed and they're hurting, I mean, people in pain and fibromyalgia, they're pretty stressed out about it, and rightly so. So then that stress physiology creates more stress chemistry, right, with stress hormones and cytokines, which further creates systemic inflammation, which is that body inflammation. And then that's going to cause brain inflammation. Now we got a loop. Some of these people have body inflammation because they have a virus, or they have gut dysbiosis or some kind of pathogen. So then that's driving it. And again, you see this loop happening. Now, I would say this, some people, they have leaky gut because the diet is just not great, or they're eating reactive foods like gluten, dairy, or whatever other food they're reacting to. And what happens is when you get leaky gut, you're going to create obviously gut inflammation. And there's actually a way for you to get from gut inflammation to actually create histamine, which is a compound produced by mast cells. And histamine is a chemical that's, you know, necessary when you have an allergy to something. You know, the histamine is part of the mediators produced by mast cells, like leukotrienes, and there's over 100 mediators produced by mast cells. And these mediators are basically enzymes and chemical that degrade pollens and dust and allergens. So then when you have allergies, right, that's why people take antihistamine, because histamine serves a purpose. But if histamine runs too high, then that can create, you know, too much allergic symptom. And so you think people do stuff to try to make that symptom go away. But when you have gut inflammation, you can actually produce this cycle where you can actually have an overabundance of histamine response. Now that can start to create a problem, because it turned out histamine can actually sensitize peripheral nerves. So we talked about central sensitization. I'm having trouble saying it just like you do, Roger. It's central sensitization.
22 years with this and I still can't say it every time.
You've got to say it a little slower. Yeah. But there's also peripheral sensitization. And there's this concept of neurogenic inflammation where your peripheral nerves, when they become inflamed, they can actually produce chemicals that will actually cause more histamine release. And then histamine will cause more of these chemicals to be released in the peripheral nerves that will sensitize them to more pain. And this is called neurogenic inflammation. So there's a way for you to become inflamed and have lower threshold for pain centrally. There's a way for you to become, have lower threshold for pain peripherally as well. And histamine and leaky gut can be a loop there, okay? Now, when you have this neurogenic inflammation, it starts to create more leaky gut, more histamine response, and that histamine can come back and create more of a inflammatory pattern, specifically a T helper 2 immune pattern, where you get a lot of antibody production. So then that make you more likely to get food sensitivities, more likely to react to things in your environment. More antibody production means also more likely that you may develop autoimmune, because antibody may start to attack cell tissue. So now you have this, again, this pattern of someone with a lot of sensitivity to things in the environment, chemically sensitive, food sensitive, sensitive to their own body, which means autoimmunity. And that all is going to drive, again, systemic inflammation again, which is going to cause body inflammation, brain inflammation, gut inflammation, and you have this loop. So it can be, so how do we calm down the sympathetics, right? So we have to look at where it's coming from. Sometimes calming down the sympathetic could be healing leaky gut, or getting rid of some gut pathogen. Sometimes calming down sympathetic could be adopting a lower histamine diet or addressing high histamine. Sometimes calming down sympathetics could be just meditation or doing vagus nerve exercise. Right. So it may be a comprehensive approach, but I just want to mention that to kind of open up the map a little bit wider in case people are just doing certain things and they're not responding. So they have a backup option that they can go to as well.
You know, so I'm listening to this and thinking as a patient or an audience member, I'm thinking, oh, that's intimidating, because anything can create this overabundance of inflammation, which creates pain, and you've already got a low pain threshold. So, you know, where do you even start? And also there's, I think there's a disconnect. People think, well, how can a food cause me to have pain unless it's gut pain? How can it cause me to have pain in my elbow or, you know, have pain in my shoulder? And really any type of toxin or any type of virus or bacteria, pathogen, bug, chemical that the body, even a thought that the body thinks is dangerous, it can get caught in this pattern where it's releasing these inflammatory chemicals and they never get turned off. And I think, you know, what explains that, gives people a kind of an idea about that, is you see people that kind of go through life, never have a problem with a food allergy. You know, they eat eggs all the time. The next thing you know, can't eat eggs. A month later, now they can't eat dairy. Next time you talk to them, now they got seasonal allergies. Never had a problem with allergies before. Now they start breaking out in rashes and bumps. And it's because they finally have gotten so toxic, you know, whether even if you're trying not to be toxic, sometimes you can't escape it. But the bucket, their bucket that's designed to allow them to be able to navigate life, it overflows and it spills over. And now they start to develop these symptoms. And the beauty of functional medicine is it's not about, oh, you're in pain, we're going to put you on pain pill or Lyrica, gabapentin, or something else to cover up the nerve, the nervous system being overaggressive. We're actually going to look at where did all this start? And yes, it can be a little bit intimidating, but for you and I, that's the beauty of what we do, is this detective work to try to figure out what are the triggers that are creating the pain, the fatigue, the irritable bowel, the brain fog, these things that we see so common in fibromyalgia. So don't let it intimidate you. Just realize that we, as you said, you're opening it up and we kind of want to look at it and realize that it's not always just a simple cause and effect. It's multiple layers. And the only way to overcome that is to get healthy, which sounds very simplistic, but you know, it's not, because until you are starting to fix these underlying causes, these triggers, you can't get healthy. You can't overcome it. So it's a process of putting this puzzle back together, you know, with different strategies that we use, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, I see it as a roadmap, right? Like this is a sequence, you know, kind of like unlocking your cell phone. If your cell phone passcode is 1234 and you type in 4321, well, they're the same digits, the same number of digits even, but you put it in the wrong order, then it may not work. So, you know, certainly, you know, in my experience, I've kind of see patterns where it helps me to kind of be able to see, okay, what do we need to fix first and second? So even though I gave you a big map, but that's really the framework that I use to kind of see, you know, the lens that I see these chronic condition through, even though it's complex, but we can kind of do it one step at a time, then that take the complexity out of it.
So I wanted to share this. I have a patient here recently that her CRP, this is CRP reactive protein level, is a marker for generalized inflammation, although associated with cardiovascular inflammation, the heart and the blood vessels. It should never be, I mean, in conventional medicine, it should be below 3. For us, we really like to see it around 1 if we can get it down there. So hers was 14. And one of the things that I found that's very helpful for our patients reducing this inflammation is finding out if they have any food allergies, because this is something that every day, you know, if you've got an allergy, you know, and you're a food you're allergic to and you're eating it every day, every couple of days, you're generating more and more inflammation every day. You're just, you know, you're pouring gasoline on the fire. For her, it really, we got it down to, we got it down to 6, and I was still kind of discouraged. I had her on, you know, all the things we do, high doses, fish oil, curcumin, numerous things. And it was just so stubborn. And then I said, you know what, why don't you do a food diet journal? Let me just see if we're missing something. And sure enough, one of the things that she was having every single morning was this shake that had in there eggs. You know, it was way down there. There's a bunch of ingredients. I didn't even think anything about it when she was telling me she was using a protein shake. I didn't think anything about it. It was pea based, so I didn't think it had eggs in there too. Sure enough, I saw that. I thought, you know what, let's just do a trial. Go off of that. Let's go off of that for 2 weeks and let's retest you and see what your CRP level looks like. Drop down to 3. So, you know, there's definitely a cause and an effect from the foods that you eat. You know, they can be helpful, but they also can be harmful. So it's a process of really trying to figure out, you know, what are some of the triggers that are creating this inflammation? And certainly food allergies are one of them.
Definitely. Yeah. Food sensitivity. And you mentioned earlier how people, you know, through the years, they start with one, you know, I can't eat this now. And then they, you know, after a while, I can't eat this other thing also. Yeah. That's called a loss of oral tolerance. Okay. Oral tolerance is how well can you tolerate the things that you put in through your mouth, like food. And when people start to lose oral tolerance, this is usually a sign of some type of intestinal permeability or leaky gut. So then these dietary proteins are, you know, leaking through the intestinal lining, allowing presentation by the lymphatic system to T and B cells to make antibody. Now, I would say this, the other reason for oral tolerance is that, again, relates back to the vagus nerve and a central mechanism, is that if you have poor vagus nerve output, remember, you don't make enough stomach acid or enzyme, then you don't digest food completely. So think of a food protein. You're supposed to break the protein down into amino acids. So if you can't break the protein down to amino acids, then that protein, if you have a leaky gut at the same time, then leaks out. That's what you react to. You cannot react to amino acids, because once the protein completely degraded into individual amino acids, there's no reaction. Yeah. So one of the reasons people lose tolerance is that they're just not digesting the food.
Yeah.
So that could be low stomach acid, low enzyme production. That could be caused by the vagus nerve issue. So then you have these dietary protein floating around when it's not supposed to, and you can develop a sensitivity to those foods. So if you're progressively getting more and more food sensitivity, it means that you're either not digesting, maybe a vagus nerve problem, and or you also have leaky gut, and or you have a increased immune system pattern, that where your immune system is making a bunch of antibodies because it's got a bunch of other things it's trying to fight, like toxins and infections. So I think for people who have increased food sensitivity, don't be discouraged. There's a reason for it, and there's a way to address it. And the solution is not to cut out every single food, because at the end of the day, if you develop a more and more food sensitivity, you become more and more restricted in your diet, then that can cause, you know, nutrient deficiencies, and that's not good either. So the goal, even though short term, we may have to cut out food that you're sensitive to, the long-term goal is to build back up the oral tolerance so that you can tolerate more food.
So people who get cut on these diets and they get more and more limited in what they can eat because they're having these reactions, and it can be from different things. I mean, yeast overgrowth can be a culprit, SIBO can be a culprit, you know, can change your what you can and can't eat and tolerate. But to me, leaky gut, that's it. So if I have someone that's telling me that I have all these food allergies, my first thought is, well, you know, you've got leaky gut. And typically when, and I test just about everybody for food allergies, I think it's low hanging fruit. You know, if we're trying to get the buckets overflowed with all these toxins and stuff, the body, because a person can't handle them, let's at least try to make sure that when they're eating every day, they're not putting gasoline on the fire. And so what I find is if I have someone has all these food allergies, you know, 15, 16 different foods that show up, it comes down to really, it's not so much the allergic reaction to the food, it's the fact that they've got leaky gut. And it really sometimes doesn't even matter what they eat, it's going to generate this inflammatory reaction.
Right. So you can have leaky gut, by the way, from the food sensitivity.
Right.
And create leaky gut, and then leaky gut causes food sensitivity. And so when we're talking about healing leaky gut, yes, absolutely. There's supplements like L-glutamine and different things that we typically would use that's very useful in leaky gut. But I think the important thing is for people to kind of see a bigger picture of like, okay, there's other things perhaps, like vagus nerve issue that can cause leaky gut, like gut dysbiosis that can cause leaky gut, like even high blood sugar problems. You know, if you have insulin resistance, you're diabetic, that's a very inflammatory state that can also cause leaky gut. So we want to be aware of those things. And I'm going to make one last mention about vagus nerve, because we started this with the central sensitization. So the vagus nerve fires parasympathetic and fires into the gut to help control digestion. But the vagus nerve is also really important in dampening inflammation as well. I think people are not knowing that as much, right? Maybe people know vagus nerve is parasympathetic, help you to be calm, help you to digest, rest, digest, right? But I think people are not aware of the role of vagus nerve on dampening inflammation. There's actually a direct pathway through the what's called an inflammatory reflex arc. So there's actually an axis where the vagus nerve actually can innervate the spleen and the liver and the intestine, small intestine, and inhibit macrophage activation. So you're not producing so much of these cytokines like TNF-alpha and interleukin-1 beta. So that's a direct way of how the brain and the immune system is connected through the vagus nerve, dampening inflammation. So if you lose that vagus nerve function or even some increment of it, then you may have an increased inflammatory response in your body. And then that can start to cause gut inflammation, body inflammation, brain inflammation, and that whole cycle starts. So now people might be saying like, wow, if it's that easy, everybody's messed up, right? Remember, your body has amazing capacity to heal itself. And sometimes our body, you know, and it depends on genetics, depends on pre-existing condition and how much stress you have. We can't forget the psychosocial aspect of it. And even, you know, self-talk, right? Like our mindset is a big thing too. It can really create this background of either you're going to have problems or you're going to be more resilient. Okay. Yeah. So this is where nutrition comes in. This is where exercise, lifestyle, all the stuff that we help people with are going to be really important to help create this tide or this environment where it's easier for the body to recover.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the points I'd like to, you know, kind of end up with is that you're as an audience participant, you're thinking, okay, where do I even start? I mean, this is, where do I go? And really you just start with the most basic things. And that is clean your diet up, you know, clean your health lifestyle up. You know, do you want to do things? It could be just simple little things that will allow you to have a little more space for this bucket, you know, to be able not to be overflowing. And that can be, again, that can be doing things, stress management with, you know, meditation and light stretching and journaling and reading healthy and material that is nurturing, like Joel Osteen or Zig Ziglar, Wayne Dyer, whoever.
Or Roger Murphy.
I don't know. They'll put them to sleep. They read my books. But, you know, I think.
They need sleep. Yes.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. I think you got to just realize that it's a culmination of these little things that you can do that can, you know, give you, make you have a lot of progress. One thing I want to ask you, how can someone, this is something I think we want to leave them with, what can they do to stimulate the vagus nerve? Now that we know the importance of it, what are some of the exercises or things that they can do at home to stimulate this important cranial nerve?
This is a topic that I'm super passionate about. You know, as a chiropractic neurologist, you know, we seek to understand and come up with as many ways as possible to, you know, to help people to be able to activate the vagus nerve. Okay. So, and so the vagus nerve can be that the action or the activity or the firing of the vagus nerve can be promoted by anything that the vagus nerve will control. Now, vagus nerve has afferent nerves, which goes into from the, basically the vagus nerve have innervation that senses the body and then goes into the, send that sensory information to the brain. And it also has efferent, which is nerve from the brain that goes out and control the body. So the vagus nerve have control over certain motor function, muscles of the throat. So we can do humming, gargling, singing, and this activity is activating the efferent or the motor component of the vagus nerve. And thereby, we're basically exercising that nerve, right? So just like biceps needs exercise to get bigger, if you exercise the nerve, then that nerve will become more stable and stronger. Remember earlier, we talked about brain cells require fuel, activation, and no inflammation. Activation means you're actually using that part of the brain. And you can use the vagus nerve, the motor part of it, by doing motor activity, humming, gargling, singing. Deep breathing, by the way, is also a motor activity, right? Because you can control your diaphragm. You have that voluntary control. So breathing is kind of interesting. It's voluntary, but it's all involuntary. If you hold your breath too long, you're going to have to take a breath, but you can also control your breathing. That's what deep breathing exercise is. So breathing really deeply and slowly can improve vagus nerve. In fact, you can measure this on heart rate variability, HRV, which is a measurement of parasympathetic activity. And really breathing, slow breathing is kind of what contributes to the HRV, because the heart rate and the diaphragmatic movement is what kind of contribute to that, the heart rate rising and falling, which is actually good for your heart rate to kind of go through that cycle. You can also do mindfulness meditation, you know, being aware in a still awareness, right? Just being aware that you're aware, right? Kind of ignore the talks in your brain. You're going to have the conversation in your brain. By the way, when you have conversation in your brain, who's talking to who? You know, So if you're actually observing your own thoughts talking, then you are not the thought, right? You cannot observe it and be the thing that you observe at the same time. So meditation is really to disconnect from that internal ego talking to itself, so that you're just being aware of the awareness, which is your life. So meditation and mindfulness is really helpful. Exercising within your capacity can be helpful. You get it during exercise, you may have some sympathetic activity, but after exercise, you get a rebound anti-inflammatory effect and kind of a calming afterwards after you exercise. Cold immersion, you may say, how does that help? I get freaked out when I jump into cold. But again, it's the effect afterwards is what we're after. Other things could be, you know, just even having, you know, a certain mindset, like having an attitude of gratitude, complimenting other people, or being complimented by others. Actually, being complimented by others is actually more powerful than complimenting others, right? Having someone being grateful to you for something that you helped them is actually more powerful than you just being grateful for what you have, actually. Connecting with nature, being out in nature is also very helpful here. Listening to music that's more slower rather than like techno music that's really fast. So, you know, there's a lot of things that you can do that's non-invasive that can help promote the vagus nerve. I think the biggest thing is really put your body in a parasympathetic state, which is a calm, relaxed mindset. A lot of it's mindset, right? It's the filter that we see the world through. And if your filter is one where everybody's after you, then it's going to be very difficult for you to get into that calm and relaxed state.
I remember a few years ago, one of my summits, and I can't remember which one it was. I can't remember if it's the first one, maybe the second one, but Eva Decco, who did a lot of work with the vagus nerve, she's a naturopath. She did a presentation all about the vagus nerve. And afterwards, I started making sure all my patients were humming in the morning, you know, and I really encouraged them to do that, looking in the mirror and sending thoughts of love to themselves and gratitude, which, you know, a lot of people are uncomfortable with that in the beginning, but it can be very powerful. And so, you know, 2 years later, I have sometimes just have this picture, Peter, of you know, hundreds of my patients over the last couple of years, every morning in front of the mirror doing this humming. And, you know, it's an exercise that can be very, very powerful. And I encourage you to those that are, you know, watching this, just try it, you know, and you may feel uncomfortable looking in the mirror and, you know, forgiving yourself, loving yourself, sending yourself gratitude. But it can be really, really impactful.
I love that. Yeah, it's almost a form of self-acceptance. And when you accept yourself, then you feel safe in your own mind and your own body. And That's a great place to start. I love that.
I think you know this, you know, with fibromyalgia, you get so down, you know, because you've got an illness that most people don't understand. Most doctors can't really help you, don't know what to do. And, you know, it's easy to get really down and depressed, but that just, you get in this maze. You know, you just can't get out of it. Your filter has become so clouded that you got this black cloud. It's hard to see the sun, you know, here. So anything you can do to kind of get out of that maze where you're just stuck. And sometimes it's just a matter of being proactive and getting outside. And maybe you can't walk more than a block, but maybe it's just getting outside and getting some sunlight. Something, you know, that simple. Just to start the process to be able to nurture yourself and get back in the game of life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peter, now your website is Ask Dr. Khan. Is that the best website for them? Because you've got some resources I want them to check out. What's your best website for them to find out more about you?
Yeah, our main website is askdrkhan.com. Okay. And we also have masterclasses that we launch from time to time. And, you know, we'll let you send that to your audience when we have them, because it's not ongoing.
Those are great too. Always recommend
those. And then I think another good resource, just, you know, free stuff online, which is YouTube. I have a pretty big YouTube channel. People can watch free videos. And I think that's a great free resource.
Yeah. Hey, Peter, thanks so much. As always, been really great to spend some time with you. And for those of you that feel a little bit discouraged, I hope we've shared enough positive message here that you can realize, you know, you can get better. You can feel better. And so don't give up. Do not give up. There is hope.